Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series focusing on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico. We also want to look at trends in national and global agriculture to explore what it might mean for agriculture and culture in the state. In this program, we will look at trends on the national level, what's happening with agriculture, land, and water, and how culture is affected by these factors. As the population continues to grow in the U.S., land and water are being transferred from agricultural use to development. It's become such an issue that states have begun to try to keep ag lands in production, or at least out of development. Maryland taxes land transfers from agriculture to development to attempt to maintain important riparian areas. Other states have adopted different zoning practices, and others are just trying to figure out what to do. This is Peter Vigil, director of Taos County Soil and Water Conservation District. He works with districts all over the country to find better ways to maintain a balance between the land and water. He explains what development is like across the nation.
Well, I would say that it's happening all over the country. It's not just happening in the western United States. We've looked into the situation, and we've found that in the United States in general, we're in a time where it's unprecedented for growth. What that means is that in no time in our nation's history has there been more subdivisions and homes being built and things of that nature. The district would probably list that as probably a top conservation priority is just the sprawl from the urban areas into traditional non-developed areas. And we see that result in northern New Mexico. We see that a lot of development is taking place. And our job as a conservation district is to minimize the impact of that development.
How do you do that?
Well, there's certain things. Planning, location. In our task, we sort of review the natural resources. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that any review that we would give a municipality or a governing agency would have the best possible information. So before a development's built, usually the county will contact us and ask us to do a terrain management review on that particular subdivision. And what that means is we're going to look at the vegetation types before and after development. We're going to look at soil disturbance before and after development. We're going to look at drainage and any concerns that with flooding or disposal of water. And we look at these things, and what we want to do is we want to make sure that the development is suitable for the area that it's located in via soils, water availability, erosion factors, revegetation factors, things like that. And we also want to make sure that there is a checks and balance system in there so that at least somebody's looking at these things, and we want to make sure that they conform or at least adhere to the regulations.
Water is the most critical component to both agriculture and development. It's scarce. In the West, water has been transferred and speculated between villages, towns, cities, states, and nations. An article written by Noel R. Golahan, a water use management program leader at the Resource Economic Division of the USDA, Water Markets: Implications for Rural Areas of the West, explains that the market transfers of water impact rural areas by transferring the water from agriculture to development. The market sees rural areas as a lower valued water user. Development is seen as a higher valued water user. In other words, the market values growing houses more than it values growing food. In the study, Golahan found that areas that transferred water out experienced a 20% decline in economic activity. That activity was transferred to wherever that water went. This would mean that an area that transferred water rights wouldn't irrigate anymore, wouldn't need gas for the tractors, wouldn't have jobs for people planting and harvesting. They wouldn't use the mill or any processing facilities anymore. There was also a higher rate of outmigration, so people left when they could no longer make a living. This is an example of how land and water use might change a community and, in effect, change the culture of a community. Other national trends include an overproduction of food by a small amount of people, Dr. Robert Jessen is a political scientist from the College of Santa Fe. Jessen explains how trade has changed agriculture in the U.S.
What's pushing it is free trade. What's pushing it is the World Trade Organization. Americans are also pushing it because part of the interesting transformation of American agriculture, which has a direct impact on developing countries, is after the progressives lost, then there was this massive migration of farmers, and American policymakers actually became concerned that we would have no farmers. So they actually sent people to Scandinavian countries to study agricultural co-ops, like Ocean Spray is an agricultural co-op that has successfully managed to stay around. But then they put in this sort of perverse system that allows us to keep our lands productive for farming, but then actually engages in a massive overproduction. So we overproduce corn, we overproduce wheat, we overproduce all sorts of things. Butter in Wisconsin, they have cheese warehouses. Once I think one of the warehouses caught on fire and molten fiery cheese ran through the streets, kind of a surreal sort of thing. England does the same thing, they have butter mountains. And so all major developed countries subsidize their agriculture because it's part of who they see as who they are. It's part of their nation-ness. Nation being a people, not a state. A lot of people who don't study politics use those terms interchangeably, but they're different for a reason. Japan subsidizes its rice production massively because how could you have Japan without rice paddies and rice farmers? They wouldn't feel Japanese anymore.
Subsidies on food commodities also affect the small farmer. Large farms receive the subsidies, making their food less expensive than others. This is Ernie Atencio from Taos Land Trust, an organization that protects agricultural lands from being developed. I asked him why people are farming less and less in the Taos area, which consisted of small subsistence farmers farming for themselves and a local economy.
I think it probably has a lot to do with the subsidized commodity food production system in this country that in this totally ridiculous way makes it cheaper to buy food that's produced in some distant place and trucked halfway across the continent to our grocery store. It's cheaper to buy that food than to buy your neighbor's food that they grew on their own field. So that might be part of it. The way the agricultural system in this country works, it favors the large industrial scale producers, not the small local producers. They're the ones who qualify for all the federal subsidies.
Although farmers' markets are gaining support and momentum, local producers can't compete with the larger markets. Dr. Jessen explains that in the areas where the majority of the nation's farming is done, there's no local market.
Well, if you're the kind of farmer who farms for a large market, then you're between a rock and a hard place. It's kind of where you have to go. If you don't want the cheap and easy short-term solution out, you're going to have to opt out of selling to large corporations and try to look around for a local market. Very difficult in Nebraska. There is no local market in Nebraska. The whole rural community has disappeared over the years. In the Midwest, in the western Midwest, it's a tricky question, actually, on whether there actually should have been farmers there in the first place. Wallace Stegner writes about John Wesley Powell, who was the first white fellow who floated the Grand Canyon. In his book, Beyond the 100th Meridian, talks about how those places shouldn't be farmed in the first place. It's actually a grazing land, buffalo grazing land. So there are lots of dynamics at work in terms of whether or not those farms, small family farms in places like Nebraska, Sandhills of Nebraska, is a place like this. But in terms of how it actually affects local economies or larger economies, it can look like it has a positive effect on the larger economy. But on the local economy, it could be absolutely devastating.
It's all kind of confusing, but we produce a massive amount of food in the U.S. Part of that food is sold here in the States. Part is stored and given as commodity food to the poor, as well as exported to other countries in order to live up to trade agreements. In 2005, we imported 59% of what we consumed, while we exported 63% of what we produced. This is all a part of the global economy. Dino Cervantes, chili farmer from La Mesa, in the southern part of the state, explains the trend of producing food in other countries as the cost of labor is less expensive.
Obviously, our global competitors are becoming much more efficient. The technology and education that they have is growing exponentially. We see it specifically in the chili industry. People always have assumed that Mexico was kind of our main competitor, but actually Mexico's under pressure from South American countries and Eastern Asian countries, and the cost that they have to pay. You know, we're paying $50 or $60 a day to a field laborer. Mexico's paying $17 a day. But you get into Central and South America, they're paying $3 or $4 a day. And you get into China, they're paying $1.50, $2 a day. So that kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier. Anything that is very labor intensive, us trying to compete in a cost market like that makes it very difficult. And then you got other things, like same issue with cotton. Cotton production here, the biggest majority of our cotton now is being exported. Most of it going to China as well. Textile mills, those types of things over there are growing astronomically. The global effect of mostly labor issues is going to play a part in what we do long term. On the other hand, we have a lot of interaction with Mexico, with NAFTA. Even though the chili industry had some issues with Mexico, because not necessarily issues, but they had a competitive advantage of us because of low labor costs. But grain producers had an open market and a new market to be able to ship grain into Mexico, for example. And being this close to the border, we also saw Washington apples. We're taking apple growers out of Mexico or make it very difficult for them to compete. So I think we have to get used to the fact that that we're going to be living in a global economy. It's going to make some adjustments to what we do. I think the big part for us is to make sure that we have that agriculture isn't just kind of left to work on their own. Hopefully our elected officials and the public as a whole understand those issues and are committed to maybe keeping us at least a certain part of agriculture here domestically. And hopefully with their commitment, we can still compete extensively. We've been growing chili in this valley for years, and we've actually tried to grow for our processing facility in different locations in Mexico. And this, there's nobody that can compete with us from a pure production standpoint up to the point that we actually harvest a crop or need hand labor to harvest it. We're the best in the world by far in this valley. And I'm sure that goes for a lot of other crops. It's just going to be a matter of you know, how committed we are to keeping those things here. And if that commitment will, overcome some of the pressures that we have from other countries.
Are there small farms that continue in the area?
There are. There are some smaller farmers. I think we see agriculture going one or two ways. We see the big commodity guys, and this is more of a domestic view of it, but the bigger commodity guys are getting bigger. If you were a 1,000-acre corn farmer 15 years ago, you're probably a 1,500 or 2,000-acre corn farmer today, if you're surviving. Then we're also seeing some of the specialty crop guys. They're staying small, but they can compete because they have a specialty item and they do it very well. Organics would kind of fall into that. Some of the specialty crops, even chili peppers and onions for us would be considered specialty crops. Pecans probably as well. The pecan growers, part of the reason that it's grown in this valley, they've taken a lot of market share from places like Georgia and South Texas and Louisiana. Partly because of our climate, but partly because they're just better at it. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to kind of see that people are going to have either a niche crop, as I mentioned, or you're going to have the really big crop where volume matters. The middle guys are kind of the ones that are getting squeezed out of it.
The global economy has changed agriculture in the way that trade agreements have opened developing countries up. This affects our national ag, as we must participate in the global economy, trading food rather than producing our own. With programs from the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, countries who have been involved in programs to help them develop their economies have in turn developed a great debt to large global financial institutions and are now controlled by the Washington Consensus, 10 Principles of Development and Trade, which essentially open the countries up for developed nations to take what they want. Our subsidized agriculture also affects these countries, as the price of our food is based on the aid that the government gives instead of what it took to produce, which developing countries aren't able to compete with. The poor countries must export their best cash crops, making the goal debt repayment rather than local sustainability. One of the largest issues in all of this is that we don't allow people to produce food for themselves any longer, either in developing countries or here in our own country. Tied into this cycle are genetically modified organisms, GMOs, or genetically engineered crops, GE crops. This is another trend in the U.S. The United Nations Cartagena Treaty Protocol, a treaty on GMOs, defines them as plants and animals into which scientists have inserted foreign genes for specific desired traits, such as cold tolerance, insect resistance, drug production, or immunity to common pesticides. The treaty signed by 142 nations calls for the labeling of food products that contain GMOs. The labeling allows people to know what they are putting into their bodies. The U.S. did not sign. This biotech engineering is how you wind up with tomatoes that won't freeze because they have flounder genes, or corn with certain bacteria from the ground to make them untasty to cutworms. GE seeds have been available for commercial use since 1996. Since that time, the U.S. has been the major grower of these crops. The major crops are corn, cotton, soybeans, canola, squash, and papaya. In 2004, 76% of total acres grown in the U.S. were genetically engineered crops. That number has since risen. In order to protect their traditional seeds, communities around the country have banned GMO crops from being grown in their areas. Probably because of this, the House Committee on Agriculture's Subcommittee Livestock, Dairy, and Poultry inserted Section 123 of Title I into the 2007 Farm Bill. The section would prohibit states from prohibiting the use in commerce of a product that the USDA has determined is a non-regulated. This is referring to genetically engineered crops. This would protect the interests of the large chemical companies who supply the GE seeds and pesticides and herbicides that the crops are dependent on. The provision was eventually taken out after public outcry. The USDA and large chemical corporations such as Monsanto and Cargill take the line that the GE seeds increase production because they are resistant to herbicides, pesticides, colds, pests, and heat that would otherwise hurt a crop. You're listening to The Shift of Land, which focuses on the connection between land and culture and agriculture in New Mexico and how national trends affect the state. One issue with the genetically engineered crops is that they are uncontainable, so that when their pollen blows, it spreads to other crops. If the crop is a traditional one, whose seeds had been saved by the farmer for years and even generations, those seeds are immediately contaminated. The worst part is that the large chemical corporations like Monsanto and Cargill then take the farmer to court for theft. In many cases, the courts have held the farmer liable. One of the best-known cases is that of Percy Schmeiser, a 75-year-old seed-saving canola farmer whose seeds were contaminated by a passing truck carrying a neighbor's GMO seeds, which blew off while passing Schmeiser's crops. The court ruled in favor of Monsanto and fined him his earnings for the crop that year, some $15,000 in losses by the corporation. Monsanto actually has an annual budget of $10 million and employs 75 people to investigate and prosecute farmers such as Mr. Schmeiser. Where there were people, there is a connection between land and their culture. This is Winona LaDuc, Anishinaabe scholar, politician, and journalist from the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She explains the connection that her community has to the land and the importance of the wild rice to culture and community. She also explains how the community protected themselves against the GMO rice that could have contaminated their natural and cultural resource.
Hi, this is Winona LaDuc, or Bine Sikwe, Indigenica, Galababani Ka, Gishkanaganing, and Dunjaba. That's my reservation, is White Earth Reservation in northwestern Minnesota. Our reservation has a lot of wild rice on it because our treaty of 1867 reserved that land because of the rice. And our story, our migration story, we began on the East Coast, and we are instructed to move to the place where the food grows upon the water, which was wild rice. And so we moved 1,000 years ago or so out to this region, and today there are 19 Ojibwe reservations or Anishinaabe reservations in the United States, a portion of this, and about 100 in Canada, largely around the wild rice area. And it's our most sacred food. I don't know, I'm not really in charge of what's most sacred or how that sacred works, but it is a very sacred food to us. And it is a food that is for all our feasts and our ceremonies and, you know, for all our essential, and it's our food that's really sustained us through all these years. The wild rice has been, you know, natural this time, but in the 1940s is when it really began. There was an intent by the University of Minnesota to come up with a way to domesticate wild rice and grow it in diked rice paddies and use chemicals and fertilizers and combines to harvest it and create uniform varieties that would all arrive at one time. They took a number of years to develop it, but by the 60s they had figured it out and 70s, and it really caused a lot of damage to the economy of our wild rice industry in Minnesota, because for us as Anishinaabe, we couldn't compete with a guy with a combine. We have been battling that for many years, that we don't think that they should be able to market it or represent it the same. In 86, we filed a lawsuit, Wabazi versus Anheuser-Busch, who had some wild rice that had two Indians in a canoe on the label of it, but it was grown in a California diked rice paddy and sold by you know, Busch, the beer company. We ended up with an agreement and a state law on labeling, that in Minnesota you have to label paddy-grown rice as paddy-grown rice. But the loophole is that 75% of all wild rice which is sold today in this country comes from California. And so you could drive 75% of the rice through that loophole. And so that's our, you know, next piece of work that we intend to do. But what happened to us is around 2000, they mapped the DNA sequence of wild rice at the University of Minnesota, which had done that initial domesticating. And there's a lot of trust issues with the university because of that. And so our tribes asked them to basically cease and desist in their genetic work on wild rice, because what we did not want them to do was to genetically engineer wild rice. And so began this battle around, I think 2002 is when we really found out about it. 2003, I became involved, I was asked to get involved in it. And in that work, well, maybe 2002 we became involved, I'm sorry, I kind of forget my sequence of time. But we started to meet with the university and explain to them our concerns that genetically engineered crops were not containable, and that it would contaminate our rice if they were able to grow it in their test paddies. There's 20,000 acres of domesticated wild rice grown in the state of Minnesota, and about 60,000 acres, I'd say more, of native rice stands. And so that 20,000 acres flows into the same watershed and is quite often proximate right next to that lake rice. So there's no containment. There's no buffer. And they actually have found out that they can't contain these things anyway. So they began this discussion with us, went on, you know, and they kept treating us really like second-class citizens. I have to say, I spent a lot of time in meetings at the U, and their argument was they had the right to intellectual freedom and academic freedom, and that we, in telling them not to genetically engineer rice, were infringing upon their freedom as an institution. And our position was that freedom required responsibility. In this case, the risk was too great. And so they would not stop with their work. They have not genetically engineered wild rice, but they would not stop and say that they would not. They continue to do their academic research with no relevance to Ojibwes. And they continue to do their work on wild rice and for marketing paddy-grown rice. And, you know, really in disrespect to our people is our feeling. So we're forced to go into legislation. And we introduced our first bill in 2004 to oppose genetic engineering of wild rice. Have been at the legislature for 3 years, and each year battled them. In each year, 2005 actually is the first year, because in 2007 was our final campaign. And each year, for 2 years in a row, I testified, and for 2 years in a row, the first opposition witness out of the gate was Monsanto. That didn't want us to say that if this was stopped in the state of Minnesota, that would send a chilling message to the biotech industry. And we said, this is about lake rice. This isn't about your crops. You know, and in fact, one of our members of our legislature, Frank Moe, wrote Monsanto a letter and asked them to back out. You know, and said, you have no business in this debate. Well, we built a lot of awareness in our communities over 3 years. We testified, and in 2007, May 8th of 2007, a bill to protect wild rice was signed into law by the governor of Minnesota on May 8th, after a three-year legislative campaign. And that bill does protect, it looks at a lot of issues around our wild rice, including the water quality issues, lakeshore development, and genetic contamination issues, and ensures that there's a study of all of those issues and potential threats, and requires an announcement. It does not ban genetic engineering, but it requires an announcement. There won't be genetic engineering of wild rice in the state of Minnesota because they won't be able to introduce it without the tribes intervening. And they're required to have our consent, and the tribes will not consent.
I'm Andrea Hanks. I'm from the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, and I'm also at the Diné Nation. I'm the Wild Rice Campaign Coordinator with the White Earth Land Recovery Project. Another part of our strategy this year was not to go through the Ag Committees of Minnesota. We decided to go through the Natural Resources Committees, and that's where it picked up. I mean, that's where it is. We were not a crop, by all means. Our wild rice is not a crop. We do not farm. We do not plant it. We do harvest it. It traditionally occurs on our lakes, on our reservations, and in various lakes around the state. So I think it being a natural resource was more in the realm of where it needed to be versus in the ag world. But because it is cultivated in Minnesota, they do consider it an ag crop in some areas. But for us, it was an issue, and we raised and educated, you know, the people, and raised the awareness that it's not just, you know, it isn't an ag crop for us. It's a cultural, you know, importance. It's a medicine for our people. And that's what actually got a lot of support for us in legislation and defined it as unique. It has a different, unique status. I mean, not only in the fact that it's a medicine for our people, but it's also protected by treaty. And, you know, the state, if they don't want to acknowledge that, well, then on some level, the federal government is going to have to acknowledge that. But we would rather do it at the state level and keep it local.
Land and culture are tied. Changing the way that we deal with the land changes our culture. Changing our relationship with the land and what it gives us changes what we are able to give back and, in effect, changes our culture. Issues such as these deal with our most basic survival, our food. Trade agreements and farming subsidies have made us dependent on mega farms and, in effect, on the large chemical corporations which supply seeds, pesticides, and herbicides. Limiting our local food economies affects our food security, in that with any lapse in transportation due to weather, energy crisis, or natural disaster can leave our grocery stores bare. Without seeds, which have adapted to areas and the food that local farmers produce, we're left vulnerable, as are the developing countries, which are forced to export their best cash crops to us. Without developing in a sustainable way, basing it on balancing with the land and what it gives, we could wind up with a market-driven development based on short-term profit rather than the longevity of our families and their families. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappet for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.